Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is the graveyard where Van Gogh's buried.
Really?
Yeah. When was that photograph taken?
Last summer.
Oh.
Wow.
It's a nice suit.
It is a nice suit.
Try it. Very Van Gogh, that suit.
No. Billy's the most stylish man.
It's not Van Gogh. His name's Gogh, and he's he's not an American. And he would never. I don't see Van Gogh in a white suit. He'd ruin it. Me and Hud were going to get these because some friends of mine make these suits, and we were going to get them. So said, like, so you've got to get a white suit, and you've got to wear it for a year for everything you're doing. You're never allowed to clean it in the studio as well. That was the. We haven't done it though. But that was
you should theory. Though. I like that idea.
Yeah. Well, that's that would fun. Be real art, wouldn't it?
Because that's verging on conceptual art, Billy.
Well, the conceptual that would be too many concepts for conceptual art because conceptual art is sort of like devoid of concepts. That's why I don't like it. Painting's got more concepts than conceptual art.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are. This is Russell Tovey here.
And Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you guys? How are you, Rob?
Today, we are out of our usual studio context.
Yes.
And we're in the Chatham Historic Dockyards. So I'm actually feeling like very historical.
And very docky.
And very like linked to the history of ship making and boats. And
yeah. It's a beautiful day. Very spring day. We've come out to Kent and it's stunning, and we're here with an artist who's very important to you, Rob, because you actually represent this artist.
I do, and we've been working together since about 2013, and he's actually going to be opening up the new Carl Friedman Gallery in Margate at the end of May with a huge three gallery solo show of new paintings, which we can chat about in a minute. And you can actually hear him in the background. He's actually starting a new painting right now.
It's very exciting.
Yeah, so we would like to welcome Billy Childish. Hi, Billy.
Hello.
How you
or
doing?
As I would say, watcher.
Watcher. I was waiting for that.
Watcher,
one.
Billy. What are you watcher working Billy. On the minute, Billy?
I'm making I'm working on a copy of a painting that is in the show, the title piece of the show, which is called Man in the Mouth of a Cave. Mm-hmm. And it's I'm just making another version of it so that we've got another reference. Or another option for how the for what we show in the exhibition.
Do you do that a lot? Do you work on two scales of one image ever?
I often work on three or four scales. And I'm not painting on Sundays as much as I used to. I paint on Mondays instead. But I would often work on a very, very large scale, then cut down. So maybe I'd be on a 10-foot. And then right the way down to maybe 2 by 1
feet. Oh, really?
And the one that looks like the study will, well, often, always the one that people presume is the study will be the last piece because I always do the small works after. And I don't do, so really the large ones are prepped for the small one often. But I do often do those on Sunday in my mum's front room, but upstairs bedroom studio. But I've not been doing that lately. I managed to have a serious nervous breakdown about a year and 10 days ago. And it sort of affected my ability to go and paint at my mother's.
Right. So you need that. You need to actually come to the studio to feel like you're working, you're coming to work.
Well, I did have a studio there. I've always done that. The reason I did it at my mum's was because everything is about work and how you sneak up on yourself and allow the thing to happen. What happens when I was expelled from St. Martin's in the early 80s, I used to paint once a year. So I used to make up boards in the summer and paint about 100, 200 paintings over June, June, July, August. And then I was expelled from St. Martin's, and I was back on the dole again. And I thought, well, how am I going to carry on this? How am I going to take this forward? And I thought, what I need to do is set aside one day a week when I paint, so I can make one painting a week. Or, well, actually, I used to make three on that day.
Right.
And that was my practice up until about 8 years ago, of painting on Sundays.
And so then, Sunday was your day, and you could do like one to three paintings on a Sunday.
Yeah.
And the rest of the week you wouldn't be painting.
I'd maybe write some poetry or work on a, right, on a novel, or write some songs or something.
And that structure helps you just to maintain that.
Well, what it is, yeah, everything is, I'm very disciplined and really able to apply myself to do things. But I'm also very fast and get bored really quickly.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, and I've never been into parties or social things or trying to better my prospects. So, because I can't do networking, because it has the total opposite effect. Because if I went along to these invites I get to galleries, yeah, and that, and yeah, met fellow artists,
yeah,
shall we call them, or fellow musicians, say, or fellow poets, what they do is they decide quite quickly that I'm an arsehole because I don't believe in the gang. I don't identify myself as being an artist or a musician or a poet. Everything for me is sort of like honesty, intellect and truth.
Uh-huh.
And that doesn't go down well with people who are trying to be something, because you might, you know, I don't think we're great. I don't think artists are special. I don't think musicians are brilliant. I don't rate this sort of third bit culture that we've got.
Uh-huh.
So you see, even by what I'm saying now could...
No, I'm thinking you...
No, I'm not, so not you, but whoever's listening. And, you know, they just, and people probably listen and say, yeah, he's right, he is an arse, and he shouldn't expand his opinions, because we're not interested, because we're...
Well, we are interested.
He's ruining the party.
Not at all. There is.
You're ruining the party.
You're bringing the party to talk, guys.
I think really you are exciting. The party, Billy.
You're
like the lone wolf.
When I was at St. Martin's, the big problem was not going to parties, or like my friends, like... I had one friend at St. Martin's, who's Pete Doig,
yeah,
and he was the only person I got on with, and he liked similar sort of music,
mm-hmm,
and similar sort of painting, mm-hmm, to a degree. And he had two mates with him who hang out, and they were sort of like, everyone had money and I didn't, and they would all go, and I didn't get on with any of these other people,
mm-hmm,
and they'd sort of go off to Paris with the school trip, which I could never, ever afford to do. And everybody was sort of like... You know, because Pete is a much better politician than I am, and a much, much nicer guy. You know, so he could get on with them and with me.
Are you still friends with Peter Doig?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. We don't hang out or anything, but we've remained. Pete's sort of like largely, you could say, he was integral to my overnight success 9 years ago.
Tell us about that. Well, how was that?
Me and Pete were mates, yeah, and. Shortly before his overnight success,
yeah,
which was a lot earlier, but still quite a way ahead,
yeah,
of St. Martin's. Because we're at St. Martin's, we presume that as painters we might get a break at 50. And unfortunately, that was true for me, or fortunately. And Pete was at Cubit Studio in, or Cubit Galleries and Studios in, uh-huh, near King's Cross.
Uh-huh.
And he... asked to put an exhibition of mine on, said, Billy, why don't we do a show of your pictures? This is about early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And which we did. And he had a friend who wanted to be a curator called Matthew Higgs, who had just, right, come out of school. And he said, do you mind if Matthew curates with me? And I said, fine. And then I ended up doing another show at Cubit two or three years later, again with Matthew. And then, of course, Pete became quite... And Pete and Matthew are fans of my work, mm-hmm, and used to come to the shows, the music shows and the poetry stuff, all the time. And, you know, I think people, probably some of those other art people did as well. I think that... what's the fella who numbers everything?
Martin Creed.
Martin, yeah.
Yeah, he definitely admired.
Yeah, Martin used to come along as well. And I did something with him one time. But Pete, I knew Pete and Matt, and they, most people said to them, well, how can you like this rubbish? And then,
about
course,
your work?
Yeah.
Really?
Art people. And then, yeah, Matthew told me that people couldn't understand what on earth they saw in it.
And is that because it was too, like, traditional in their eyes or something, the idea that you were doing paintings at that time?
Well, I got into a lot of trouble for being a painter at that time, and I had a lot of arguments with Tracy, who, Tracy is an old girlfriend, Tracy Evans, an old girlfriend of mine, when she was studying fashion down, after I was expelled from St. Martin's.
Why was you expelled from St. Martin's?
Writing confessional, indecent poetry, non-attendance, talking back, really sort of like being a general pain in the arse.
I would call that cheeky.
Yeah.
I think you were like that at school, weren't you, Russ?
Yeah, I didn't write anything indecent, but
yeah,
I,
well, they
I
said it was
back.
I was publishing this very strong confessional poetry, which they didn't, because you weren't allowed to use that sort of language those days freely.
Well, but if you published that now, would it be as...
I still do.
But is it now shocking just, now? Or?
No, of course not. It's totally different. You can have it written on a T-shirt now.
Yeah, exactly.
When I was put on probation on my foundation course for doing a political post that said, fuck off, and doing hardcore pornography, because I was really into Dadaism when I was 17.
Right.
And that got me into... That caused a lot of trouble, although I painted at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It's all going back. I'm reading this all backwards, isn't I?
No, well, you started off conceptual then with the Dadaism. That's how.
Well,
you...
not really, because I started painting from when I was little, and I painted old paintings from when I was 12.
Right.
And I carried on painting old paintings. And I didn't see Dada as conceptual. I saw it as anti-art.
Mm.
And I'm anti-art as well.
Would you say use outsider, the term outsider?
No, I wouldn't. No.
I know you're trained, but you wouldn't.
No. I wasn't trained. Nobody's trained. That is one of the worst misunderstandings. I mean, I was tutoring up at Royal College, and like the kids up there couldn't understand why I was coming down here to go do life drawing in the evenings. I said, they say, are you going to come to the pub? I said, no, go do life drawing in Rochester. And I was in this dockyard as an apprentice stonemason in 1976 when I was 16. And I couldn't go into art school because I've got no qualifications. I'm a secondary school boy. And I just drew for 6 months when I was here.
Mm-hmm.
I did about 600 drawings of all the people. And I taught myself to draw really after secondary school, although I was good at art. And I wasn't allowed to apply to my local art school because I had no qualifications. And I got into St. Martin's in 77 on my drawing.
Wow.
But I wasn't allowed to go to St. Martin's because the grants were paid by Kent. And they made me go to the art school that wouldn't accept me, wouldn't even give me an interview, which was Medway.
Right.
And they said, if you can get to St. Martin's, you're getting anywhere without qualifications. They used to have this thing called a genius clause. And if you showed outstanding ability, that you could wiggle through. And so then I was put on probation there because I was really into my Dada stuff. And I was a punk, one of the only punk rockers there. And then I got into, and then I was on probation and not allowed to finish the course. So they wouldn't give me a certificate to say I'd finished foundation, which meant I couldn't study painting. I couldn't go on to a further education.
Mm.
So I took up I just put my suit and hat on and had a little suitcase of collages and things I'd made because I was a massive Kurt Schwitz fan. And I went up Charing Cross Road and went into St. Martin's and went into the art department and showed them my collages, and they accepted me onto the painting course. And that was in 78. And I was really into, but I was really into painting. So I went in September 78, and they were showing, we had to talk about art and what was going on in there. And they had slideshows.
Uh-huh.
And they showed some Van Gogh. And I said, this is the only decent stuff you're showing. And the other thing I liked was the political Russian posters they were showing. And that was
propaganda was.
Yeah, and that was really like that. I was really disliked for that because I liked, but they said the Van Gogh stuff's like old lady painting. And the other stuff, they said this is an example of what art isn't, not what art is. So they showed these pictures to us in the slideshow. And I said, this is good. And they said, this is an example of art. This is an example of what art isn't. And so I left after a quarter of a term, walked out. Because they were doing these big abstract expressionist things I didn't like. And then I was on the dole playing in groups and stuff for 2 years. And Thatcher came in and said, you've got to get a job. So I applied to St. Martin's because I couldn't. They'd had me before. So I applied to do painting at St. Martin's in 79, it must have been, when Thatcher was in. And I was in there in 1980 for round two. I got in again on.
Was it the same tutors?
Some of the same tutors and people who
did they got, welcome you back or
well, some of them were okay.
Yeah,
they didn't like I wrote this confessional poetry. They and my only friend was Pete anyway. And my father went into prison at that time for drug smuggling, and I had no grant because my father was meant to give us money, but he left when I was seven anyway. And my father didn't give money. Then he went to prison, and my mother couldn't get any money. So my attendance was poor, and I was running a small press, doing publishing confessional poetry, which was I was getting the stuff made at Medway College of Art on the Xerox machine.
Was this Hangman Press? Was that yours?
Yes. Yeah, it was Fire Rod and then Hangman Books, and the work got confiscated by the principal of Medway. And they wouldn't let me have it back. And my tutor in London, I think he's now head of St. Martin's, or was, Bill Henderson, he said, where is your work? And I said, well, it's been confiscated. And then he tried to get it back. And the head of Medway College was friends with Simpson, who was head of St. Martin's.
Yeah.
And so then it came back to me, what is that student doing publishing indecent poetry in Medway? Why isn't he in class being a good boy? And what's he doing this music stuff? And Bill Hendon said, I don't know. Not I said he could.
Right.
So then I got they did a thing like I had to work to rule. They did a work to rule on me that I had to attend. I had to sign into the course every morning at 10 o'clock and not leave until 8 or 4 or whatever it was.
It was like an ASBO.
Sign-in thing.
Yeah.
And I had no money. I didn't live in London even. And I painted at home because they said, where are your painters? I said, they're at home. And they said, why aren't you painting in the college? And I said, because I don't want to get contaminated.
Mm.
So they just sent me a letter saying you are no longer a student at this course, on this college.
Do you think you was ahead of your time? Because I'm sure now a student like you would be really celebrated and really exciting, and the fact that you had the initiative to go off by yourself
I don't know. I'm not sure, but it didn't work out very well that way. And I just wasn't really... I went to a secondary school where tutors were... I wasn't a violent or unpleasant kid, but tutors who didn't get respect could be punched, and no one listened to a tutor you didn't respect at a teacher at secondary school. And these people were demanding quite a lot of respect for nothing. I mean, one of the conversations I had when I was there was this tutor told me that my attitude, I had a very bad attitude, I didn't come in, I complained about everything. And I said, well, you've got a bad attitude. You're usually down the pub. You don't come in and you're complaining. So and he said, I should have the courage to leave. And I said, well, you should have the courage to resign. And I'll leave if you resign.
Did he resign?
No.
Oh. But you left?
No, I was thrown out.
Oh, you were thrown out. Right.
And then, so I made lots of enemies, really. And then I came back down here and I was running this is when I transformed the way I painted from once... generally through the summer, which of course didn't fit with St. Martin's idea of how you work. And I actually started working each week, which I would have much preferred, but I needed to do it for my own discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing poetry readings, which was, you know, I had a lot of trouble with poetry readings, being banned from poetry readings and doing reading on TV where I was the one who was excluded and all of this stuff. But then I, shortly after that, I met Tracy, who was studying fashion at Medway.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd seen the paintings around the bedsit I lived at, where other people lived. And she wanted to do painting. So she got friendly with me. We were boyfriend, girlfriend for a couple of years. And she became the administrator for Hangman Books, selling books. We used to set, because I couldn't sell books in London, can't sell stuff. So Tracy, we send her up to London and she'd go to the bookshops and sell loads of books.
No way.
And she used to, and then she got onto a foundation course in London. I can't remember what it's called. It's a very small college because she wanted to do painting.
It wasn't, is this before Goldsmiths? Or
oh,
this...
she didn't.
No, she went to Goldsmiths. She went to Royal College of Art.
And she was, what are they called? John Cass. I think she went to John Cass. Mm. And then she got into Maidstone to do printmaking. And I used to use all the printmaking facilities, and we used to make hangman, get the, she organised readings over there, and we get the, what do you call those guys, the technicians in the summer holidays to help print up books. And I go in and use all the woodcutting facilities because I applied to Maidstone and I was told there's no, I couldn't go to any other college after being expelled from St. Martin's. No one would ever accept me. And then Tracy, we split up and Tracy went to the Royal College in mid-80s,
mm-hmm.
85, 86. And I carried on painting and drawing and stuff and doing what I do.
So you've always had art through all of your life, really?
My father painted. Yeah, my father wanted to be a painter. And my auntie painted. My grandfather was an able seaman from Gillingham. But for some reason, my auntie's sis went to art school. Well, I didn't know these people in the sense that, you know, I'd see them once a year or something. But I know auntie's sis did painting. And my father painted when I was little at home. And then when he left, all his painting gear was there. And my brother was really into art, my older brother. And he's sort of like the opposite of me. He went to grammar school, Slade, Royal College, and he was a star student at all of these places. And he had all his qualifications. And I was the, you know, I'm the runt of the litter. And so I wanted to be, like, when I was a kid, I was listening to Jimi Hendrix when I was seven with my big brother who was listening to this stuff. And I just emulated my big brother and wanted to be a painter. And my mother likes art a bit, and we had art books in the house.
Oh, right.
And I saw, you know, the Prince of Van Gogh up and a history of art, lots of history of art. My brother was really into it. So I was sort of trying to explain to people that I was looking at sort of like things like Andy Warhol and Bacon and these people when I was about 11 or 12.
Right.
And got it out of my system, you see, because I think that's very adolescent sort of work and not my type of thing. But it's not like I haven't seen stuff.
Yeah.
And I saw the Rothkos when they first hung, because I would go to London on my own and go to art galleries when I was little.
Did you?
I saw them.
What was your first art gallery you went to?
Probably the Tate. And I remember seeing those Rothkos thinking, they're not much good, are they? I probably prefer them now than I did then.
Yes.
I was really into, I had a big Salvador Dali period when I was 12, which is the ideal age to have Salvador Dali period.
Yeah, totally. Mm. I think I had a bit of a Dali moment with the soft watches and the
it's fantastic when you're 12. It's ideal. It's just when a lot of these
sci-fi.
And even like Francis Bacon, you know, I'd sort of say that would be sort of like maybe 14, 15.
I agree, actually. And
it's what it's about. It's scary. That's the thing with Bacon. And kids want to be scared boys. And what it is, it's a nightmare. There's nothing wrong with Bacon's pictures. Some of the early ones are quite good, but it is like life shit, then you die, is the painting. Yeah. It's like a picture of an inner nightmare.
Yeah.
And that is a portion of life. It's not true. It's just very particular. It's like a microscopic view of an aspect of life, touted as a lot of modernism is, as being the whole experience. And that's why it's not valid. Because when you look at someone like Van Gogh, the reason it's valid is because it's encompassed all aspects of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at the old masters, that's what they do. When you look at Delacroix, they sort of like, they encompass the whole universe. And if work's not universal, it's not art, really. Art's got to be universal. You look at, I mean, it doesn't mean that you can't find Bacon sexy or be into Warhol for it. Like I was into those car crash things when I was about 12 or so. My brother brought that stuff around. And it's okay. It does something. But it's such a limited aspect of who we are. And art isn't meant to be about limits. You know, it's meant to show you the universal. And that's why painting always wins. and always will win. I mean, Damien Tracy said, "My painting's dead. That's never gonna. That's over. It's all finished." And I actually said to Trace, "Well, you're gonna have to paint one day again because there's nothing else to say what you like."
And now she's painting. Now it's like.
And Damien paints as well. But yeah. I think if you waste 20 years not doing it, it's a bit of a mistake.
Yeah.
Because I was really ridiculed for being a painter and carrying on.
Wow.
Well, because that Brit Art stuff was cool, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I wasn't cool. I'm still not cool.
But you know what, Billy? I first met you when I was about 21, and you came into the course I was doing in Harrow. Do you remember that music course? And you came in and gave us a lecture about self-publishing your own music and running your own record label and all that stuff.
Probably recording. I'd never done any publishing, but yeah, I get the...
You know what I mean? Like releasing your own records and stuff.
Yeah.
And... I remember being so inspired by you because of that exact reason, that the idea of like no limits and the fact that you were making paintings, you were doing poetry, you were making music and all on your own terms. And to me, it was just so freeing because I'd grown up where it was kind of like you're either a painter or you're a musician or you're a poet. You know what I mean? It's all separate.
Yeah.
Or you're an actor or you're something else. But to me, you've always kind of encompassed like so many different types of creativity. And I love that about you. And I think that's really rare that you've been able to kind of stick to that and just always have confidence in that.
Well, I think that it's not so much that maybe I am confident, but there's actually no reason why I should be. What it is it's like, it's not something I've tried to, the way I work and the way I've done things, there's never been any effort because it's like a reflection of what I'm like. So it's been easy for me because it's like there hasn't been a choice. I mean, the BBC came and tried to do something with me in the early 80s, and they wanted to use my poetry and my paintings in a programme.
Right.
And they were sort of like, and the director was trying to buy paintings off me. And then they realised that they couldn't use the poetry because it's too explicit. And then they wanted something really street, they thought, but they didn't want anything like I was doing. So then they went for this more sort of hip-hoppy type thing with some cool kid, and then they said, well, we still want to buy your painting, we want to use your pictures and have this poetry over them. I said, well, want away, because you're not having it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not selling the paintings, and I'm not doing that. But that wasn't just that wasn't a stance, that's what I'm like.
It's not an act.
It's not even not an act. It's like I'm not trying to be like what I'm like, and that's what people often don't get, because it's not there's no choice. So for me, it's easy. For other people, it would be a conundrum. Mm. I mean, when I was asked to do Celebrity Big Brother at some point,
were you?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And we were playing, and I'd never seen it. I'd not even a telly, and we were playing up in town, and I said. My friend showed me something. I said, it's not very good, is it? And they were offering me this money to do it. And I said, well, look, the show, I'll tell the audience and I'll take a vote on it, whether I do it or not. And someone said, well, that's dangerous, isn't it? And I said, not really, because I'm the one who counts the votes.
And what happened?
Well, obviously he didn't do it.
Oh, right. No, I know, but how many people did vote in the room, or what did people?
I saw it as a majority against.
Yeah, that, you not doing it.
Yeah,
yeah. And what did they offer you? Good money? What sort of money?
Well, I had no money at all at that time. They came to me with 15,000. They offered me, and then they said, when I said I wouldn't do it, they said, well, what would you need to do it? What do you want? Because they didn't go for an agent, because they don't have agents or people.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
And they said, well, what would you do? What do you want to do it? And I said, I want you to understand that the people who won't do what you want for money is what I want you to understand.
Mm-hmm.
I said, and if you want to make a program about something I do, then I'm happy to do it.
Yeah.
But I can't see this program really is like that.
No. I mean, you would have been fascinating in there, but it's the right choice.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Art, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
Yeah. So Billy, talking about not having agents and things like that, you in the last few years have actually started working with a few different galleries, and what I've always loved about your choice of how you've decided to work with the, you know, art world as such, is that you've kind of ended up working with people that have actually been genuine supporters of yours for a long time, like Tim Neuger and Burkhard Rimschneider in Berlin.
Yeah.
Neuger Rimschneider. Can you tell me a bit about how you met them and how that all began?
Well, the thing with Tim was, what happened with, when Matt Higgs ended up being a curator in New York.
White Columns.
And there was another kid whose first show was done with me, is Martin.
Is he a painter?
No, he's a curator of the art centre in Camden.
Oh, what's his name?
Oh, yeah. Martin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We just with him.
Yeah.
Yeah, Martin worked down here when he studied, and he studied under Higgs, I think.
Oh, right. Martin Clark.
He's just started running the last six months. He's been running right.
Well, Martin then asked, Martin's another person who came to me and asked me to do his first show with when he was a kid. And then, so these people moved in. These are the only people I know. I know Tracy, Pete, Martin Clark, Matthew Hicks. I think that covers it. And Tim Neuger, because Tim Neuger came over when he was about 22 with his mate to do an interview with me for an art fanzine. And they put me in a little exhibition when he was working for working for a gallery in Cologne when I was with some cool American kids. Matthew Kelly's an entertainer. Oh, who is this other guy? Someone Kelly.
Who's that?
Sean Kelly.
Sean Kelly?
No, American guy.
Gene Kelly?
No, not Gene. Anyway, I did this thing with him, and like, of course, like then, what happened was, is in the year Scout was born. 2009. So in 2009, that's my daughter.
Yeah.
Matt finally said, "Right, I'll get you an exhibition at White Columns. I'll come over and have a look at the work."
Amazing.
And I said, "Oh, brilliant! All right." So he turned up. And he turned up to look at the stuff. And he said, "I was just speaking to a friend at the ICA. And they asked what I was doing here. And I told them. And they said, will you do a show at the ICA as well? Because the ICA was going tits up. And a really good guy was leaving. They were going. Everything was in transit. And he said, will Billy do a show for us as well?" So they said, "Right, you've got a co-current show opening in 4 months. One in White Columns and one in ICA solo shows." And... that's obviously for the Matt. That's why Pete is important, because I know Matt, you see.
Got it.
And we did a... So then I suddenly had these two exhibitions running. And the ICA was... I think it was... You know, it got slated basically by that Guardian guy. What's his name?
Adrian Searle.
No, Adrian. I met Adrian Searle. He's a very silly man.
Jonathan Jones.
Jonathan Jones, yeah. Another silly man. he is very silly, because the things he wrote were very silly and unintelligent. It was the best attended show they'd had.
Well, I was going to say, because I went to that show and it's packed. And I remember the curator at the time, Mark Sladen, saying
Mark's
it was
brilliant. Yeah,
because Mark really believed in you.
Yeah, that's right. Mark was great. And it was their most successful show they'd run as far as, people walk coming across the doorstep. Yeah,
yeah. It was so exciting though to actually see you in a big museum. Like, I remember the excitement
and
of it.
And then, it's good fun. I enjoyed it. And then, and Mark's brilliant. And but nobody, there was no critical response to it. The same actually. You know, I was on the front cover of ArtScribe in 1992.
Were you?
Yeah, by some German person who did shows in Germany, and I got sort of like model front cover with my mug on it of ArtScribe, which went nowhere as well, apparently. So I've always been about, but then...
so this was the overnight success you were talking about?
Yeah, in 2009.
Right.
Something like that, isn't it? Yeah. And so then nobody was interested. I didn't get approached by anybody, I don't know how you do that thing. I'm not that bothered. But then Matthew met Tim Neuger at the airport, whose plane had been cancelled. He said, "Why don't you go along and look at Billy's exhibition?" And Tim came along and said, "Do you want a show with Neuger and Schneider?" And I said, "Yeah, sure."
Gallery based?
Berlin. They're in Berlin.
Right.
And then we heard nothing from him for 6 months. We thought, "Oh, well, he must have gone off the idea." And then 2 weeks, he gave us about 2 weeks, said, "We're coming to collect paintings. We're doing solo representation at Art Basel." And I don't know what Art Basel is, because I've never been to an art fair before in my life. This is the funny thing. When I said I went to art galleries, I stopped doing that when I was about 12.
Why?
I don't like them. There's too many people and things. I'd go in and they're empty.
Yeah.
And I'd never been to art. You know, I'd go along to look at a painting. I will go along to look at one thing or two things.
Of course.
I've only recently gone to exhibitions again. When I say exhibitions, Delacroix and that, because my son, to help my son
learn
stuff.
Yeah, nice.
So I've gone with Huddy.
Do you find them easier now to go to? Or
yeah, so much. I didn't used to be able to go into supermarkets.
Wow. But
I don't like noise and stuff, which yes. is awkward being a musician.
Of course.
And then, and I don't, you know, not into any of that. But anyway, so then I had this sudden, and I had to sell that show at Art Basel. And then an American gallery asked to work with me. And then Carl, Tracy, I'd known Carl because she went out with Tracy. Mm-hmm. And Carl was going to do an exhibition with me at South London Gallery mm-hmm. when Tracy had told him about me. Because Tracy became friends with Carl when she used to hang around with those Sarah Lucas and that lot, I think.
No, it's true. When they were doing the shop, isn't it?
Yeah. And Carl said, oh, this is just amazing. We should do an exhibition with him. But it didn't work out.
Well, not then, but then it did later yeah. come but then, back, which I like, though, that idea. Because yeah, even Tim Neuger went to all your gigs, didn't he, when he was younger?
He went to some, he must have. Yeah. But what happened was, so that's how I knew Carl. Because I knew, got on with Carl all right in the mid-90s. Because Tracy used to try and get me to go to these, even though we weren't boyfriend, girlfriend, she used to try to get me to go to these exhibitions. And I went to the one at South London show. I think I went to one there, and I went to one of Sarah's because I liked Sarah.
Mm.
And they're the two shows I went to, and they used to try and get me to go to parties or hang out with those people because I couldn't do that. And I'm not.
Right.
So, because I was, you know, I thought that was really poor Dada, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being a Dada snob.
Yeah.
Being a man who has Kurt Schwitter's tattoo.
Yeah, what is that tattoo on
his left buttock?
On your butt? What does it look like?
Probably totally unreadable and spotty. It was done when I was 17. It's I don't believe in ideal, I eat the apple with the peel. Kurt Schwitter's poem. And we made a film about Kurt Schwitter's when I was about 19 as well, like 16 mil with a friend of mine called The Man with Wheels. And I used to write sort of Dadaist poetry because before I did confessional work in poetry, I used to be really into Edward Lear and nonsense poetry.
Right.
That's how I got into it.
Uh-huh.
And then it was only Pete Doig gave me a copy of a Berkowski book when I was at St. Martin's. And I thought, great, so you can write about all the shit that's happened to you. And that sent me off.
Do you still write poetry now?
Yeah, I've got a collection.
Got a new book coming out.
I've got a collection coming out for the exhibition.
And yeah. Do you still do this printing yourself for this? Or is this?
No, this one, well, it'll be published by, I think I'll do it as Hangman Books, this one. But really, a lot of my publishing went to working with Steve at L13. And we really, really, Hangman Books turned in, you know, my stylistic and what I did turned into L13 books.
What's L13? That's just a different
L13 is based in kind of Farringdon in London.
All it is a mate of mine, a fellow who used to be into the music. And he came to me because his pal was selling my books. Rare books, quite expensive rare books. And Steve was running this into rare books. He's someone who did paint when he was a kid
uh-huh.
and got talked out of it. And then he did rare books. And then he decided he was working with Jamie Reed and Jimmy Corti
yeah.
right.
and with me and put an exhibition on of my stuff. And I convinced Steve to become a painter again and not do all of this.
Which he's done really well, hasn't
political
he?
Crap. Isn't and then, although we still do some political crap for fun, you know, some anti-Brexit stuff. But Steve, I worked with Steve and he's my mate. And then when Neuger from Schneider said, will you come with us? I said, as long as my mate can come with me, because I don't, you know, this is what he was getting to is I'm friendly with people.
Got it.
Yeah.
I'm not under contract with anyone. Neuger and Schneider, I give them complete call over what I do and how I do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because Tim said, we'll work with this guy when no one else would.
Yeah, exactly.
So this poetry about wheels, how does that go? What are the wheels?
The man with wheels.
Yes. Well, who's the man with wheels?
Kurt Schwitter. There is a man with wheels, it said, who has the use of wheels instead of legs. But he can, if he chooses, put his hands in his shoes and wanderest around on his head. It's sort of based on a little, some of Schwitter's little graphic drawings and things, where you've got men walking upside down with wheels here and there. And I sort of like thought, all right, I like that. Kurt Schwitter's got good sense of humour. You know, he was disliked by the other Dadaists for being too bourgeois, which I thought was great, and not being political enough. So, you know, I felt a big affinity with Kurt.
Do you Do you remember most of your poetry?
No, that's one of the only ones I do. I can remember some of the nursery rhyme ones.
Go on then, give us
I can't
rhyme.
Do the confessional stuff because God knows what it's about. Let me see if I can do one of my favourite ones from when I was 17. It says, sing, shed, sing. Sing, shed, sing. Oh, that's all I can remember. Sing, shed, sing. The tortoise are in their boxes. Sing, shed, sing. The holes are filled with foxes. Sing, shed, sing. The autumn is near, the autumn is here. Sing, shed, sing. The flies have flown, the thing to sing. Sing, shed, sing. Something like that.
Wow.
I like that. I would use that as a warm-up for doing a play.
Oh, that's, really? That's what, like to get your vocal
She sells seashells on the seashore. It's slightly like sing, shed, sing.
Yeah. So do you do that before you go on stage?
Yeah, I always do like... Blah, 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 blah. She stood upon a balustrade balcony. Well, I'm going to get... Inexplicably mimicking him, hiccuping, and then I'm probably welcoming him in.
Wow. I'm going to get you a book of Billy's poetry then.
Yeah,
and then you
please.
Can read it out.
Yeah, but
I haven't got the...
I don't think there's much of the Dardorist stuff about.
And do you remember the stuff then that was shocking and got you expelled and
no, not
in
really.
Trouble?
I'm not really that. Actually, I'm not even interested in any of it. But not really. No, I mean it's. I've got terrible memory. Because I play music and stuff, I can never remember lyrics of things. It's just some of those. You know, I probably wouldn't be one of these people in an old people's home, and all I can remember of things from when I was five or something. Hope not. No, I won't be one of those.
So in the background right now, Billy's actually drawing with charcoal onto a canvas, and it's an image of himself inside a cave. And the exhibition we're going to do in Margate is called Man in the Mouth of a Cave, which again is from Billy's poetry, no? Or is that just a title of a work?
No, I think that's the title of the work, yeah. It's, I don't think it's poetry, that one.
Oh, okay.
I might have done it as a poem since, I don't know.
And what is success to you?
Well, we were asked we made an LP ourselves when we were punk rockers, which we recorded down here after I was walked out of St. Martin's the first time before I was expelled. And people said to us about success, and we said, well, and even at that age, must have been 18, 19, we said, what you're already successful. Doing what we want, the way we want to do it. I was brought, I fell for the punk rock line in 77. And they said, you do it yourself and you don't have the other people doing it in its principle. And I thought, well, that sounds great. And that's what I've done.
Right.
But that's not because, again, don't misunderstand me. It's not because I'm sort of like, it's only because that's what I'm like. I'm not... what I'm trying to get on this picture is get this really ridiculous lean in, as exaggerated as
I can. Yeah, because as we've been stood here, you've redrawn this guy, probably about, this is your fifth attempt?
It's not an attempt.
Fifth version.
I wouldn't call it an attempt. What it is also because I'm distracted talking, but even when I'm not, because the thing that's going to be the problem with how I'm working and turning around to talk to you guys, not drawing, is that it will gradually get really realistic. And this drawing doesn't need to be.
Uh-huh.
Right.
So what you've got to do is you're looking for the essence of something, because you see this version here, how badly done that is. It's got to look as bad as that, and this is already looking better.
Why would you say that's badly done?
Look at it.
But is that so there's more, you can kind of interpret it in a different way?
But this thing here isn't, I mean, this is a million times better than this, which is going to be a good bit of drawing.
Right,
and but this one's finished.
Yeah, so yeah. This has somehow, because I'm talking to you guys, it's not got the automatic wrongness.
Right, right, right.
And this, so what I'm going to have to do is try and backtrack and get the automatic wrongness in this.
So wrongness for you is right?
No, in this instance. Well, because in this, you see, this is the inner energy of that figure, whereas this is going to be the exterior energy of it, done by someone who's reasonably good graphic eye.
Uh-huh.
And I don't insert myself in my pictures very much, but here I will have been sort of like just correcting continually because I'm talking to you guys.
Yeah.
So what I'll do is I'll have to sort of strip back and try and, because the picture should dictate what it looks like, not you.
The picture should dictate what it looks like.
So you say you do acting, don't you?
Yes.
Well, you know what I'm talking about there.
Yeah.
Because nothing's different. the character dictates what you act like, not you dictate to the character. Because
yeah,
otherwise,
yeah.
you've got yourself
in there too much.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what, and these things, this is how creativity works. And that's what this is. That's when you do it as an ego practice, which art, painting, and a lot of modern art is done as an ego embellishment. That's why it's wank. And that's why a load of actors aren't any good. That's why when you see, if you watch Colonel Blimp, and you see The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp by Paul and Pressburger, and you see the people acting in that, and they're parodying and working at doing Victorians, or you look at David Lean doing Great Expectations. Is it Great Expectations he does? And you see how they can embody a Victorian person back 50, 60 years ago, 70, 80 years ago. They can embody a Victorian person. The actors don't look like dummies wearing fucking uniforms. And if you look at a period piece done now, and the idea now is, oh, these people are the same as us, essentially, aren't they? And yes, they're essentially the same as you, and they're nothing like you. They've got no similar beliefs at all. These people think that we are the best. You know, if they're doing British Victorians, they don't even think they're the best. They know they are.
Got it.
Totally different attitude. And haven't got this weird liberal skew on something. So how can you begin to embody someone when you can't even... Well, how can you act someone when you can't embody their attitude of how they're going into the world?
Well, my way of breaking it down is that there's two types of actors. There's instinctive actors, and then there's technical actors. And I guess what you're saying about the art is that with your art, you're instinctive, and the work you're making is very instinctive. It comes from you, and you're using yourself, but it's bigger than you. Whereas if you were technical, then that's maybe the ego.
Yeah, but it's not coming from myself, you see, because it's coming from itself. Well, you know, it's like the more you insert yourself into anything, if I'm baking you a cake and I insert my need for that cake into that cake, oh, well, everyone uses currants. Wouldn't it be interesting if we used something that no one ever uses before, you know? Because then they'll say, oh, that's a great cake. Billy invented that. And then you eat the cake. You go, what the fuck is this cake? And I say, yeah, but it's original.
Mm-hmm.
And it's by me. Whereas if I just sort of like follow what the cake, taste the cake and follow what the cake requires, then it's about the cake.
Got it.
It's the same as making a painting. Everything has to follow the requirement. And the less of you there is in it, the more people think there is of you in it.
Did you get frustrated sometimes because you feel like you are too much in the work?
No, because I don't care. I just sort of like realise that... Because I don't make paintings I like, I make paintings.
Right. So what would a painting be like if you was to make a painting you liked?
It does happen.
Yeah.
But that's not... I can't force it. I mean, some of them I like some of the time, and bits of them I like. You know, I like that character. Now, I quite like that painting.
Mm.
But I can't make paintings like that. You know, I can't reel those off.
So, Billy, there's a painting over there on the other side of the studio of Julie swimming through water. And there's a big theme of, like, water in our new exhibition that's coming up. And it felt like quite a new departure for me, even though you've had kind of... boats before and that kind of water. I'd never seen people actually swimming or being in waterfalls and things like that. How has that come about?
That was purely because Huddy, I think it was Huddy, my son, went with his family, his other family,
yeah,
to Montenegro.
Mm.
And Chris, his stepdad, whatever he is, wherever Chris is, took some photos of him in the water. And I sort of like saw that and I thought, that's good, I'll paint that.
And you often start from photographs.
Yeah, I like photos a lot. Because I have got no imagination.
I don't believe that.
Well, I've got a very poor imagination. My scout, I'm doing stuff with Scout. She's my daughter, 9. She likes cartoons. She says, how do you draw these feet on this thing? I know roughly how to do stuff. I said, look at Walt Disney and see how they does Mickey Mouse feet. Don't I said... Don't need to invent anything here. What you got to do is like your character, Mickey Mouse's feet. Just see how people do it, what they do. Because a lot of people are trying to, again, insert themselves. You know, there's originality is totally overrated. All you've got is authenticity, authentic response. That is what will make people think is something's original. Because it's an authentic response. Van Gogh is not original, it's an authentic response. Van Gogh has just picked up loads of stuff off of loads of people and bunged it all together as an authentic response. It's not original in the slightest. I mean, it's sort of like copying Delacroix, Gauguin. Anyone he's with is copying Rembrandt, if he's looking at Rembrandt's. And it's just because it goes through his bent lens and it comes out and it all accumulates. You know, he's tasted all the stuff and sort of like thought, well, those go together,
all
right?
So all the people you've named, they're all your influences, right?
Who did I name?
Van Gogh. Rembrandt.
Delacroix. No, not, don't know if they're interested. They're people I admire. My mum read me Lust for Life, a biography of him when I was a little boy, and I sort of like decided I'd like to be a painter. I thought that seems good because I like painting, and it wasn't maths.
And on that theme of things that have inspired you, we ask every guest on the podcast, if you could do an art heist or take a touchstone artwork out of a museum and take it home, what painting would you choose or artwork would you choose?
I'm not sure, really. That's something where you could say it's a good influence on, like Van Gogh, because he had the prints, didn't he? Prints up on the wall. I'd probably like a nice little Kurt Schwitters.
Yeah.
Just a nice little small Kurt Schwitters. Anything else?
Do you live with art in your house?
Got some of my paintings up. We used to have lots up, but we don't much have many up anymore. Huddy gave me a painting that I've got to put up in the bedroom. I don't listen to music and I don't really get involved in art too much.
And the other question we ask is, it's a hard one, but what is your favourite colour?
Oh, that's a good one. That's like real Alan Partridge. You know, there's that really good one on the radio when he was interviewing this racing car driver and he said, what's your favourite colour car? I thought it was really good. My favourite, hanging around with kids is good, you see. My children, they would sort of, when I was little, my favourite colour was red and my brother's favourite colour was green, which I thought was insane. But I do really like green now. But if you, if I say to my daughter, I love you more than anything and anyone else in the world, she would accept that. And if she said, well, what about Huddy? I say, well, I love him more than anything else in the world. And she would accept that because I understand it's the same thing. So, and I've talked to the children about colours before and they say they like all the colours.
Mm. All right.
But grey is a very, very, very underrated colour.
I like grey.
Grey is one of the best colours going because grey loves every other colour.
Mm.
Right.
I think yellow looks amazing with grey.
You like orange.
I realised that recently.
I've been painting
my new place in Margate grey, though.
But nothing else. Well, it's really overused now, and people use horrible greys, and they don't use any of the... you see, you've got pink grey, blue grey, all of these lovely types of greys.
Mm.
And people do everything like it, but grey is... complements everything, whereas a lot of people now think, hey, wouldn't it be cool, we could be like the pesky bleeders off of television, that awful program they did.
I don't know what that is. What's the pesky bleeders?
Peaky blinders.
Peaky blinders. Yeah, yeah,
the
okay,
pesky
cool.
bleeders, you know. It's sort of like parallel dark world of fantasized nonsense. Uh-huh. Where everything's gray and blowing up. Uh-huh. I don't know. People are being punched.
I like grey. I've got parts of my house coloured in Battleship Grey, which Battleship I saw at Donald Judd's house in New York on Spring Street. He had painted all the doors and window frames in that. So I went.
Well, Battleship Grey is a very underrated colour. I agree.
Yeah, I'd imagine you'd like Battleship Grey.
I love Battleship Grey.
Yeah, and actually, Billy, being surrounded by your paintings right now in this studio, there's so much colour in your paintings. In the last few years. Why do you think you started using colour so much more in the paintings? Because I swear when you made your earlier work, it was more like black on...
The thing is that everything's... You can only prove anything by capturing time. If Prince Charles wants to prove the English language is going downhill, he has to be quite specific in his time frames.
Mm.
of when it was perfect and when it was good and when it was, so it wasn't good before then and it's not good after this point.
Right.
And then you can prove something. So like when I was, my biggest influence when I was, 14 would have been Fauvism. I was really into the Fauvism. Can
you explain what that is?
Fauvism, that's Matisse and...
Bonnard?
No, Bonnard's later. Post... No, earlier. Bonnard's,
no, earlier.
Bonnard's post-impressionism. There's Velmanic. Matisse is the most famous Fauvist. And it's all colour. Like, it's, that means to the wild beasts, they were called.
So that's Monet, would Monet have been part of that?
No, he's impressionist.
Okay.
No, this is real colour. Crazy stuff. Looks like German Expressionism. Proper, garish. Colours that don't fit together. It's the beginning of people losing...
rules.
Losing the putting colours together that push and vibe for...
Attention.
No. Don't keep trying to get your thing in.
Sorry.
I tell you, I had a brilliant thing. This bloke... there's this guy used to, because as well as those art people used to come to see our shows, music shows, lots of comedians. And Hughes is someone, what's Sean? Sean Hughes used to come a lot. And he came in and made a documentary of me before he died. And he's trying to make documentaries and he did all this filming around. He went to interview my brother in France as well. He tried to find my father. And Sean would never ever, so he's got, they got the camera going, he's asking me questions, he never ever let me answer what he'd said. He always guessed what I was going to answer and you're never ever right. As lots of people try and guess what I'm going to say at the end of a sentence and they're never ever right. So anyway, Fauvism. And so that
Braque.
Was very
Durand.
Durand is a Fauvist.
There we go.
Yeah, we got
George Braque.
Braque, no, but he's he might have done some. A lot of these guys messed around. Schwitter's probably tried some Fauvism.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the what happens is they're not leaders in it. Braque's more mates with Picasso, and actually Braque had to hide all his stuff from Picasso because Picasso would go around to see him, and so in the end Braque learned to cover up whatever he's painting because Picasso just kind of rip it off.
Well,
Braque's really good. I like Braque. And that's the then that reminded me. I was trying to tell you about being self-taught or not, because I didn't go to. You ask Pete Doig if you do one with him. Ask him what he learned in art school. If they taught him a single fucking thing, and he'll tell you nothing. Because I never noticed anyone teaching me anything other than trying to make me not do what I wanted to do.
Right.
And there was virtually zero life drawing at St. Martin's in 77 or 78 when I was there, yeah. And there was zero life drawing at Medway College when I did my foundation. All the life drawing I did on my own anyway, which you could say self-taught. But in music, you've got this situation like now people go to school to learn rock music, don't you? And Imagine sort of something like, I mean, there's never been an artist who isn't self-taught, really. Mm. And Pete Townsend, they don't sort of say, well, he's not bad for somebody who taught himself to play guitar. Obviously, Pete's stuff is another issue. I mean, Pete Townsend did some very important work up until 67 or so. And I'm sure he'd be pleased to hear that. And but, you know, no one sort of says, oh, well, he's self-taught. You know.
No.
And but they will do soon, like musicians. They say, oh, this person's a self-taught musician because I haven't gone to school to be taught how to do it.
I think I've always thought the best advice for like being creative is just to keep doing it and just sort of stay on your, whatever your path is, just don't give up sort of thing.
Don't give up.
Don't give up. Maybe that's a nice moment to tie up the interview.
Here
we go, see, I'm finishing his sentences.
On the great words.
You were like, give up. Everyone else, give up.
So Edgeworth was talking to me. I make these paintings of Edgeworth over there, these totally other style paintings. We do these together, and which is where the painting really totally leads, and I don't have to use any abilities that are on show, which I used to paint like for a big long period with a lot of garish colours as well. In the 90s, when people said, because I didn't used to bother showing that I could draw. I really, that annoys people as well. It's so easy to annoy people. And Edgeworth was saying to me that he puts likes on things and likes all these sort of pieces of work that other people do that aren't any good. And he doesn't particularly like anyone. I said, well, why do you do it? And he said, well, at least they're getting up in the morning and doing something. Mm. And I said, it'd be better if they didn't, and you're encouraging them. Because the world now is full of people who want to be artists, poets and musicians everything. Whereas, people used to think that was for sort of like misfits. And you say, I'm one of these misfits still. I'm actually one of the original proper misfits who probably would be an artist in any period because there's nothing else sensible I can do.
Right.
Whereas, and then we just got all of these people involved in the art world who would have nothing to do with art 50 years ago and in the music world, because that would be, they have sensible jobs. But there's no jobs out there, so they just can come and contaminate creativity with their sort of like banker-like attitudes. We were playing at Reading. Someone got us to play Reading with the Buff Medways, one of my groups, and I'd never been to that type of thing. We went there, and there's this group on, I think they're called Coldplay. And there's this guy there, and I said, that bloke, the nearest he'd have anything to do with music 50 years ago would be in management. They'd be better off. A lot of these people would be better off being estate agents or something.
When we interview Chris Martin about his art collection.
We'll pass that on. Thank you so much, Billy. Everyone listening, you can visit at Talk Art on Instagram and see images of artworks we've spoken about. Billy's show in Margate at Carl Friedman Gallery is opening on the 25th of May and will be on all summer. Thank you for listening. Thanks. Thank you, Billy.
Thanks, Billy.
Sorry.
Good to see you. Love you, Billy.
I am such an ass.
Thank you
Thanks
so much.
Billy. Sorry. Good ending.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diament and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Recorded at Spiritland London by Anthony Shaw and edited by Gareth Isles. Subscribe to Talk Art on iTunes and Spotify. Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.